even with the most planning you could imagine, things go awry. Welcome to a special edition of Shield of the Republic. I'm Eric Edelman, joined by my partner in all things strategery, Elliot Cohen. Elliot, when last we talked, we speculated that by the time our regularly scheduled podcast would be available to our viewers and listeners, that the U.S. might be at war with Iran. And here we are.
Yeah, here we are. On Friday afternoon, I was contacted by my editor at The Atlantic, and he said, you know, when you turn your computer back on Saturday night, be prepared to write. So, which I did. It's been intense, of course, for both of us just following this. I think there are a lot of, obviously a lot of big issues here. Let's start with the first one. And it's probably the broadest one possible. Do you think the administration knows what they're doing, that in the sense that there's a coherent plan and a reasonably coherent set of objectives?
Let me start by saying that the world is a much better place without the Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei in charge of Iran. And I don't mourn for any of the other 47 or so senior leaders of the regime who've been eliminated in this operation. And I certainly hope for a successful conclusion of all this, and that our servicemen and women who are in harm's way have as little in the way of casualties as can possibly emerge from this magnitude of an operation. Having said that, I am a little concerned about kind of the administration's shifting sort of rationale, both for you know, the timing of this, as well as shifting discussions of how this ends, whether it ends with regime change or does it end with some kind of negotiation with some remnant, you know, of the regime. And the president said both things over the last several days. I'm also troubled by the fact that, and we can go into that in some more detail. I mean, I the president said some things that are worrisome in the sense that it suggests that, you know, his understanding of the details may not be, you know, very, very profound here. I mean, that won't come as a shock to anybody, but I worry about that. You know, his seeming surprise that the, you know, Iranians are attacking their Arab neighbors, his seeming surprise that he can't find an Iranian Delcy Rodriguez to negotiate with. That's not reassuring. I'm also concerned that he just has not done very much to prepare the American people for this. And today he had a bit of a press availability in the White House. It's the first time really that he's made himself available. Throughout the weekend of military strikes, he was, you know, releasing videos on Truth Social. But the public's not prepared for this. And so he starts much less public support than the Bush administration did in 2003 for Operation Iraqi Freedom, or even, you know, President Obama for his counter-ISIL operation in 2014 and 15, and or the war in Afghanistan after 9/11. There is much less margin for public support here if things start to go sideways.
Yeah, well, I agree with all that, and I also would like to stipulate at the beginning that I think the destruction of a good chunk of the senior leadership of the Islamic Republic, and to the extent that they can be defanged, particularly of the missile inventories and so forth, I'm absolutely all in favor of that, and I wish them luck. And I think it's legitimate, given that the Islamic Republic has been waging war against us and against Israel for quite some time. So I agree with that. I mean, maybe I just frame it a little bit differently. You know, I don't think either of us trust Trump's judgment. We certainly don't trust the judgment or even the maturity of the Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth, and boy, that, you know, he was on display today, you know, sounding like an angry teenager. Kristi Noem, I mean, Homeland Security is going to be quite important, conceivably. We've already had one terrorist incident in Austin, which may be related to this. There could be more.
The FBI, which the director of current director has reoriented towards support for immigration enforcement operations rather than counterterrorism, and having dismissed a number of people who had been involved in counterterrorism investigations dealing with Iran, I mean, that's a whole set of issues, too.
Right. You know, he's not prepared the American people. He faces, I think it's even a little bit more acute. His own base, I think, is going to find this problematic. I mean, the J.D. Vance cannot be happy about this. There's no good news in any of this, I think, for J.D. Vance, who definitely wants to be the next president. I think that if you look at the MAGA coalition, the isolationists will not be happy. I think the Israel/Jew haters in MAGA will not be happy. I think the residual element of people like us who have not broken with Trump will be squeamish on constitutional grounds, because there is clearly a constitutional question with Congress not getting and being involved at all, except getting a few briefings at the very top. And those constitutional issues are serious. So I think it's in that respect, it's very problematic. I don't think, though, we should, you know, there's one tendency I've noticed in the commentary, which is, particularly from people who share, you know, the kind of view of the administration that you and I have, but in some ways even more so, you then therefore assume that this is going to be a terrible, hideous failure. And that's not necessarily true either. And so I think while we note those things, you know, it's incumbent upon us to try to figure our way through, you know, how we think this might unfold, and what are the forces that are at play. So I'll just throw out a couple, and then I'm curious to see what yours are. One, you know, I always believe in opening the aperture a little bit wider. Russia and China, silent, basically. I mean, some pro forma squawks, but nothing. And I think that's significant. The second thing that's significant is that the Iranians chose to lash out at all of their neighbors, particularly the Emiratis and Qataris, but also the Saudis, and Kuwait. And there's probably a strategic logic, which is you make them suffer and they lean on the Americans to stop. But that has backfired, at least thus far as we can tell. And it has, I think, clearly reinforced the determination of those Arab states to say, we need to have these guys gone. I mean, they are just like mad dogs. So that's, I think, a broader piece of context there. And then the final kind of broader piece of context has to do with the global economy, closing the Straits of Hormuz. And that one's up in the air. I mean, oil prices are up. We'll see how long that goes on. So that's, I think, part of the larger setting. But do you have any thoughts just on the broader context here?
Well, no, I agree with pretty much everything you said. I do think that they were concentrating in the first day or two on Qatar and UAE and some at Saudi, knowing that those countries have a particularly close relationship with Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner, and hoping that they would. Part of the strategy that they had was to try and regionalize this, impose costs on the U.S., and get those guys, by regionalizing the war, to put pressure on the U.S. to kind of bring this to a rapid conclusion, because their ultimate objective is to survive. You know, if they can survive the first onslaught, that's a victory for them. So I think that's what they were trying to do. As you say, I think it's, you know, they've miscalculated all the way along. They've, I think, completely miscalculated with Trump. And I think they now have miscalculated with the Gulf Arab states. I note with interest that one of the major target sets has been the Iranian Navy and the IRGC naval forces and naval bases. And I think that was early on by intent to try and make it harder for them to close the Strait of Hormuz. Closing the Strait of Hormuz, by the way, also is a bit of a double-edged sword for the Iranians.
Right. Because
it also means that they, you know, can't export any oil, and that's the lifeblood of the regime. They have to be able to do that. And it's also the case that the Saudis and Emiratis have, over the last decade or so, built a number of pipelines that enable them to circumvent a closure of the Strait of Hormuz. So, you know, although that's always been a kind of Iranian, you know, sort of Damocles that's been holding over people's heads, it's not as powerful, I think, a threat as it may have been once upon a time. I agree with you that, you know, look, there's a chance this could be, you know, successful. But, you know, successful in what sense? I mean, sort of, you know, in an ideal scenario, the regime would collapse and, you know, you'd get either the Shah would come in, you know, Reza Pahlavi would come in and, you know, be a figurehead monarch, sort of like Zahir Shah was in Afghanistan for a short period, you know, and then turn the reins over to, you know, some civilian government, you know, after elections. The problem is there's no kind of really organized opposition, you know, to turn things over to. There are no real political parties. I mean, the regime, like other authoritarian totalitarian regimes, has done a pretty good job of, you know, destroying civil society. I mean, Iranians, to their credit, have sort of self-organized in protest, but self-organization and protest and self-organization, you know, into a political entity are not the same thing. So, you know, having the happy ending and soft landing here, while I think it's theoretically possible, doesn't strike me as likely. Now, there's another kind of success, I suppose, that would be next to that, which would be, or, you know, one remove from that, which would be, and the president seems to have been musing about that in an interview he gave to the New York Times. You know, you get some regime element that is willing to negotiate with you and cut some kind of deal. I mean, I saw over the weekend there was speculation that Ali Larijani, who had been the nuclear negotiator, is now the secretary of the Supreme National Security Council and is kind of overseeing the transition of leadership from the supreme leader to the next one, might be a candidate for that position. I find that very hard to believe personally. But maybe there's some other figure who can play the role of Delcy Rodriguez. The president seems to be looking for this. And then you would, you know, cut some deals. Now, the downside, of course, is that you would be once again selling out the Iranian people. I mean, it would be very much sort of, you know, akin to 1956 in Hungary, where, you know, the United States had a lot of very forward-leaning rhetoric and then, you know, did nothing to keep the Soviets from slaughtering the Hungarian freedom fighters. So that's another, you know, possible kind of, from Trump's point of view, maybe happy ending, not necessarily from anybody else's point of view. But there's lots of other sort of, you know, permutations and combinations here that, you know, could be, you know, kind of less salutary. I mean, you could have, I know, you know, for instance, Karim Sajidpour believes that, you know, whoever succeeds this is going to be someone from the IRGC. It's going to be worse, you know, or a harder line anyway. But, you know, maybe they'll be just, you know, for a while licking their wounds, you know, and won't affect Trump.
They'll certainly be licking their wounds. I mean, I do think we need to remind everybody they have taken a real beating and they're continuing to take a real beating. And, you know, this is a country that was already economically in the pits anyway. So I tend to agree with you. You know, the best thing would be if the regime suddenly collapsed, which is not entirely inconceivable.
It's very conceivable, actually.
We've seen those. I mean, it's a corrupt, rotten regime and those things, and the Iranian people, who are a young population, as people should remember, you know, has been extraordinarily heroic in terms of being willing to stand up, and they hate them, which makes me, one of the things that puzzles me in this, by the way, is why nobody's trying to arm them.
Yeah.
That doesn't make
sense. The point our producer makes over and over again.
Yeah.
I mean, if the CIA knows how to do anything, it knows how to run guns.
Yeah. Well, right. And we did it in Afghanistan too. So I don't understand that. I think the idea that you'll get somebody else who's within the system is the more likely thing. And, you know, the big nut in the middle of this is, even though it's a massively unpopular regime, you have hundreds of thousands of people who have benefited from it or who are complicit in it with it, and they're the ones with the guns. Now, you know, look, at some point people can flee, at some point people can change sides, so those things can happen. I think, you know, one angle in all this, by the way, that I've written two pieces for The Atlantic about this. The second one is, we really are talking about this as if it's just an American war. It's not. It's a war in which we actually have a peer partner, and it's, I don't think people fully understand that the Israelis are doing as much heavy lifting as we are.
Before we get to that, Elliot, I know you have some really, really good and important points to make about this. Before we leave, though, the possible outcomes,
I wanted to lead to that because I think,
okay,
but part of what the Israelis, I suspect, have been thinking about more than we have is, you know, what can you do to bring a different kind of regime, whether it's either through collapse or some other regime element? Because somebody made the argument, and I think it's correct, that the Israelis have decided that they will not be able to retard the nuclear program indefinitely, and not just the nuclear program, but all the other mischievous stuff they do. And even if they simply rebuild a huge missile force, that's bad enough for them.
Right.
And so something has to change in a big way. And so I suspect that the Israelis are actually very active, probably working with us, maybe working with other folks like the Brits, in trying to foster that. Now, how successful, who knows? Is there anybody to talk to? You know, are they telling you the truth? Who knows?
Well, I mean, the Israelis have already started to hit kind of regional besieged headquarters and other elements of the sort of regime's repressive apparatus. And that certainly is, you know, potentially a way to weaken the regime and empower the public. Although, again, there is this question of, like, you know, who controls the guns. I mean, there is another, you know, I would say the other potential branch or sequence of this is, you know, the regime does collapse. You know, maybe there's infighting and, you know, internecine struggle, and everything just breaks down. And Iran just becomes kind of a failed, yes, warring state.
Yeah.
I mean, you've got Azeris, you've got a Baluch population in the southeast.
You have Kurds.
You've got Kurds.
Arabs.
Arabs. You've got, you know, you've got a kind of mosaic of, of ethnic groups. It's not just Shia Muslims either, you know. They're Baha'i. They're Zoroastrians. I mean, it's a very mixed bag, and you know, you could see the place just completely fragment, and that creates, you know, problems of its own, including, you know, securing the nuclear sites in a scenario like that.
Yeah. Although my guess is that both we and the Israelis would rather have that problem than the Islamic Republic as it has existed. I mean, I think, you know, one point that a number of people have made, you've made it, I've made it, is, you know, that regime really, the premise of its existence is hostility to us and the desire to destroy Israel. That just is. I mean, right. It is patent. It's from the beginning. I mean, in that respect, not in others, but in that respect, they're kind of like ISIS or Al-Qaeda. I mean, this is just, these are just not people you can negotiate a reasonable deal with. Now, you know, the next generation may, even if they're kind of brutal and hard, may be different. By the way, just one other thing on the Iranian side of this. I think, you know, you've got, again, you have two different schools from people who've studied Iran closely. On the one hand, I mean, I think you and I have been following the Danny Citrinovitz, who is the head of the Israeli military intelligence Iran desk for many years, who has a constant stream of commentary on X. And he's been consistently pessimistic. They said, you know, they're built to absorb this sort of stuff. They have layers upon layers upon layers. And then you have other people, including, I would say, more Iranian exiles, which both a plus and a minus, the way it's always the case with exiles, who I think tend to emphasize the fragility of the regime more. And above all, you know, its deep, deep, deep internal corruption. And I, you know, for the life of me, I can't tell who's right. I do think it's a little bit glib to say, okay, you know, one Ayatollah gets knocked off, they'll find another one. Maybe for the first round or two, but I think after a while, it begins to wear on you. Now, you can argue the Israelis did this with Hezbollah, and Hezbollah is still around, but substantially weakened. I think it may be more difficult in a really large country like Iran. And I think there may be more people of the sort of the Rafsanjani type who are, you know, basically in it, more in it for the money, and not particularly in it for the ideology, and will be willing to cut deals even if they're nominally part of the same system.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I'm kind of agnostic about all this. First of all, I think, you know, I think it's a regime that is difficult for outsiders to, you know, understand. Although clearly possible to penetrate, I mean, as the Israelis have demonstrated. And I mean, I think what you were just saying about people being in it for the money has been by and large the way the Israelis have gotten in there. I don't know when you kind of fracture this stone, you know, with a hammer, how it breaks and splinters. I confess to being very unsure myself. And I think anybody who says they're very sure about it is probably not very knowledgeable.
Yeah, I mean, epistemic humility is my battle cry.
Yeah. Why don't you talk a little bit about the Israeli dimension of this? Because you, I think, as a military historian, have a very important point of view here.
So the point I made in one of my – first, it's very striking, I suppose not surprising – that most of the commentary in the United States focusing on this is entirely an American war. And that's just not true. I mean, people sort of acknowledge, yeah, the Israelis are involved. I mean, the Israelis are basically a peer air force here. We have not fought alongside a peer air force since World War II. Just to give a sense of comparison. So the Israelis on the first day, 200 strike aircraft, something like 550 separate strikes, because these things carry multiple munitions. Just by way of comparison, the Brits during the first Gulf War, when they were still a reasonably considerable military power, deployed 60 strike aircraft to the Persian Gulf, most of which were frankly pretty second rate, and in some cases dropping munitions that were downright counterproductive. But just to push that comparison a little bit further, if you were to compare the Royal Air Force today, which is still regarded as, you know, one of the better European air forces, it is half the size of the Israeli Air Force. They have fewer F-35s. The Israelis have 48. The Brits have, like, I think, 40. All the rest of the British airplanes are Eurofighters, which are not so great. The Israelis have 66 Strike Eagles, which can deliver an enormous bomb load, plus F-16s, much more advanced technology, much more experience with precision bombing, much better target selection, you know, plus a very, very deep intelligence, special operations, covert action branch. So it, in some ways, actually, the comparisons with some of our other wars are mistaken, because where we have had allies in the past who were useful, but on the whole, pretty minor. Here you are operating alongside a peer, above all, one whose intelligence capacities are in certain respects equal or possibly even superior to your own. So that's, I think, one big thing. The other big thing, just to maybe just restating another point, I think for the Israelis, I think there is more of a strategic conception, and it does involve seeing if it is possible to, you know, to effect some kind of profound change in Iran. And, you know, to that, most of the, what they will be doing on, along those lines will be in the dark. And you know, you and I won't know. I did actually doubt that most people in the U.S. government will know either, and will it be effective or not. You know, that's all a mystery. I mean, unless you had something else on Israel, I was going to mention something else that...
Just one other thing, which is the Israelis are putting out much more useful information about the operations than the U.S. I mean, what CENTCOM is putting out is like, you know, basically very bland and not very useful. I thought the Pentagon briefing today was not particularly helpful in understanding exactly what was going on. I mean, that may have been by intent. And you're getting, I mean, I know, for instance, there was a background briefing for reporters over the weekend, the White House did. I've not been able to find a transcript of that.
Yeah.
Normally those things used to be published, you know, even though the identities of the briefers would be, you know, masked by, you know, a bland description, Trump administration official number one, Trump administration official number two, whatever. But I haven't seen a transcript. I've seen references by Mark Caputo and on X to the transcript and maybe some outtakes from a transcript he has, but there hasn't been one posted. And I just find it striking that, you know, as you say, the Israelis are carrying at least half the load here, if not more, and yet they're putting out much more useful information by which to kind of judge what's going on.
Yeah. You know, the one other, I think that's right. I think the, and a lot of this is the Hegseth style of dealing with the press, and also the president's style of dealing with the press. Although interestingly, you know, in the press conferences, so most of the people in the room are actually from these right-wing outlets like the Daily Caller and so on. They were asking perfectly normal questions and getting Hegseth angry, you know, at anybody asking questions. I mean, there really is just a juvenile quality to that guy. You know, one other angle on all this that I find disturbing, just looking at a lot of the commentary, which again, there's kind of frequently the sense of certainty, which on both sides, I mean, both people are in favor and against, which strikes me as completely inappropriate. It is that instant desire to scratch the Iraq itch and pull at that scab and say, we've seen this before. This is just like Iraq. And then, of course, the next word you get is quagmire. And both sides do it. I mean, actually, you know, Hegseth immediately begins going on and on about it. I mean, part of what was so inappropriate about his press conference was it's extremely partisan. I mean, he's going after Obama. He's going after Bush. And I think this is partly because you don't have particularly good commentary, particularly from journalists who have some sort of sense of perspective. And it's going to be crippling if we view every single military engagement overseas as, is this Iraq or not? I mean, we went through something similar after Vietnam, and that was also extremely damaging. And it's also inappropriate because it's, you know, it's a different enemy, it's different tools, you know, the nature of war has evolved, the coalitional environment has evolved, but it's just a reflex, and unfortunately gets fed by social media and by angry voices, and the result is to make everybody, I think, more strategically stupid.
Boy, do I totally agree with that. you know, someone said to me, oh, what do you think, like, you know, how does this compare to Iraq? And my answer was, there are very few points of comparison, actually. I mean, I think it's not at all the same thing, for many of the reasons that you mentioned, but others. I mean, for all the conventional wisdom that there was no planning before March 2003, as you know, there was considerable planning. Now, some of it went awry because a lot of things, you know, when you start military operations, and we've said this before, when you step off the line, you know, war, as Clausewitz teaches us, is nonlinear. Yeah. And it, you know, things happen, and we ended up facing an insurgency that we hadn't anticipated. It took us too long to recognize that. It took us too long to adjust to that. But it wasn't because we didn't have, you know, a lot of planning beforehand. We did. And the point I would say, if you want to make a comparison, the point is, even with the most, you know, planning you could imagine, things go awry.
Yeah.
And here you just get the sense that there's not much planning for, you know, we're going to eliminate all their military, you know, capabilities and degrade the repressive apparatus. And then what?
Yeah, I agree with that. Although I think it's also, you know, we also should remind people is, we will go through self-flagellation because that's one of the dominant modes of public discourse. It's much worse on the other side. I mean, it's not like, you know, some of the particularly foolish commentary says, well, you know, being bombed improves your morale. It kind of causes a rally around the flag. That almost always comes from people who have never had a bomb go off near them. It's historically not true. I mean, it really is not true. You can look at, say, the reports of the German Sicherheitsdienst during World War II, that the Germans did not kind of get more committed to the war because they were being bombed. And, you know, the psychological pressures on the Iranians have to be immense at this point, too. And it'll be more immense as their command and control is going to get disrupted. Look, among other things, there's probably all kinds of cyber attacks going on, so they're having trouble communicating. If you do communicate, you worry whether your next thing that's going to happen is you're going to suck
a bomb drop on you,
a 2,000-pound bomb. So, you know, and you're probably not sleeping in the same place every night and so on and so forth. So this is one where there's an enormous amount of pressure on just about everybody. And I have a feeling you and I are going to continue to talk about this one for weeks to come.
Well, that's my final question to you as we wrap up this special edition of Shield of the Republic. How long do you think this can go on? I mean, the president has said 4 to 5 weeks. The Secretary of Defense said this morning, I'm not going to put a time limit on it. It's up to the president. But you and I both know, we were just discussing on Friday with Seth Jones, that there's physics involved here, not just politics. And, you know, as I understand it, we fired a lot of TLAMs, Tomahawk land attack missiles in that first volley on early Saturday morning. We don't have an unlimited supply of those. We need to maintain those war reserve stocks for potential contingency, particularly in the Indo-Pacific. The missile and air defense interceptors have been worn down by supply to Ukraine for 4 years now, and to help defend Israel for the last year and a half. How long can we operate before, you know, physics starts to just take its toll?
So I don't think it's entirely linear, in that a lot of it depends on what are the critical munitions and what is the other side able to do to make us consume them? You know, let's say, you know, the extreme favorable case would be we obliterate all of the Iranian ballistic missiles. Then you're probably not going to be using THAADs. I mean, you may need something else to shoot down the Shahids, the drones. But if the ballistic missile threat is completely eliminated and you're no longer consuming THAAD, we still have a lot of 2,000-pound bombs that you can drop with GPS guidance or laser guidance or, you know, things of that nature. And so I think that's the thing. You know, you can adjust what you're doing to your stocks. The one thing you won't be able to do is you do have to be able to defend your allies, and that would force you to consume the interceptor. So I think that's going to be the critical thing. If the Iranians can force you to fire off lots of interceptors, then there's pressure to bring it to an end. If they can't, you know, there are a lot of 2,000-pound bombs in this world.
That's one reason why I think the Israelis have been going after launchers. I mean, and they indicated that they had destroyed what they claim was 50% of Iran's launchers. And the theory of the case there, of course, is you go after the archer, not the arrow.
Right.
I mean, I don't know how much confidence I have that their BDA is accurate. And I did note that Chairman Kane today in the press conference said, hey, it's going to take us a couple of days here to do the BDA and understand kind of exactly where we are. And you and I both know, you in particular from your work on the Gulf War Air Study, know that, you know, pilots always think they hit the target.
Right.
And come back and provide great report about how they disabled the target. And usually we find out that, maybe not so much, after the fact.
Yeah. Although in this case, look, you'll have what they used to call during World War II, a flaming datum. How do you know submarines there? Well, you see a cargo ship in flames. This one, if the ballistic missiles are still flying, you'll have some sort of crude measure. But I think particularly, if the Iranian attacks on their neighbors have caused those neighbors to say, okay, we really need to see these guys crushed, and the United States can now fly out of bases which are within easy flying range of Iran, and where you probably have access to considerable stockpiles of munitions that those countries have, then actually I think you may have extended the life of the campaign. I mean, that could be one of the particularly counterproductive things that the Iranians have done to themselves.
Well, if that eventuates, we'll see how much patience the American people have for a prolonged campaign, and we'll have to have at least one more, if not more than that.
And this is for a future thing. We haven't talked about the constitutional piece of this, which I don't take lightly, and I don't think people should, but that's a separate.
And we'll have more to say about that, I think, once the Congress is, they're back today, and we'll see what they have to say about all of this as the days go forward. And I suspect we'll be back with another, if not more than one, special episode of Shield of the Republic.
Indeed. See you later this week.
Okay.